when you look around your town or city, I wonder whether you see much in the way of public art. It could be sculptures or installations or indeed statues or monuments. A lot of them have been there for a long time. I wonder whether they hold value for you, and if so, what is that value exactly? Do you think your community commissions enough new pieces or decommissions enough older ones? Something that might have been challenging and trend on trend once may no longer have any relevance. Is it ever moved? And let's not forget the big question we're asking tonight is, should public art remain in situ for time immemorial? Or do you think it should be removed around, replaced, renewed, maybe a bit like an art gallery? And should it be critically assessed from time to time for its actual cultural value to a place? Or should it be viewed as a lease on public space rather than a permanent fixture of the landscape? And I wonder whether you see it as a living record of the history of your community. This week, we saw an extraordinary move by the Hobart City Council. They voted to remove the statue of former Tasmanian Premier William Crowther from the city centre due to offensive acts he committed towards Aboriginal people back in the 1860s. It's a very interesting debate. I wonder what you think about it. 1300 800 222. Join the conversation. Text on 0467 922 702. It's not just historical figures, of course, not just the Captain Cooks that we're talking about. It's also installations of other things as well, particularly modern sculptures, which many, of course, over the years have taken objection to. Joining us tonight on the program, Claire McCracken is a practicing artist and has produced a number of public artworks and is an academic at the RMIT School of Art. Claire, good evening to you.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. And also joining us is Nancy Cushing. Nancy is Associate Professor in History at the University of Newcastle. Nancy, good evening to you.
Hello, Philip. Hello, Claire. Hello, listeners.
Yes, hello to everybody, and more power to all of us. To you, Claire, first, before we get to the controversy about the removal or not of public art, let's step back a bit. What actually is public art anyway?
Well, it's actually incredibly broad, and I think that any of your audience members that are artists would understand that. But because we, you know, are often on the move and moving fast when we walk through the streets in our neighbourhoods, we mightn't realise exactly what is defined. Of course, things like the infamous Stones Against the Sky that you mentioned, or the Vault, which is more commonly known as Yellow Peril in Melbourne.
When Stones Against the Sky was known as Poo on Sticks, I seem to recall.
That's right. They are, of course, public artworks, and they fit into the category of permanent public artworks. But there's lots of other examples, like in Brisbane City, for example, you have the Outdoor Gallery, which is made up of a collection of light boxes, banners, vitrines, and those works rotate, and they rotate quite regularly. We call them public art platforms. But then other examples across rural Australia might be the huge murals painted on silos, or big things like the Big Bogan in Ningen. But also temporary
artwork. Is the Big Bogan an example of public art, is it?
Absolutely. Formally commissioned by local government.
What about the Big Prawn on the map? And the Big Banana? Are they public artwork too?
Well, anything that's accessible by the public. Of course, the Big Banana is built by an entrepreneur, not by local government. And artists aren't always involved in big things, but many are. I mean, even the Big Koala was built by an artist.
I don't think the Big Merino was built by an artist, was it? Certainly the Big Banana wasn't. I'm sure the Big Prawn wasn't.
I'm not sure about the Big Prawn, but the Big Trout of Anamitabi, built by an artist.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. I've driven past the Big Trout. Yes, okay. Okay. What's its value and what's its place, do you think? Why do we have it?
I think it can be really complex. So the silos and the big things that we've just mentioned, they're putting small communities on the map. They're trying to stop the passing car in awe so that people disembark, spend their money and engage in those communities. Sometimes it's about wayfinding. It can be a really prominent work that you see beside a freeway that signals that you're approaching a place that you might be ready to turn off from. In the case of temporary works, they can be done to revitalise sections of the city. So Melbourne City Council in the early 2000s had a whole series of temporary works in the laneways, which were designed to bring those laneways back to life, which of course has been an incredible success because those laneways are now some of the most vibrant parts of our city.
Yeah, I mean, some cities and towns seem more fervent than others in creating and commissioning and decommissioning public artworks. How does it happen anyway? Is this part of the problem that councils and governments get involved here and therefore that's why we have so little of it?
We've learnt a lot of lessons. So the first lesson was really learnt with the vault, which was architects proposing.
You better tell us about the vault for those who've not who don't know about this. This was a sculpture in Melbourne, wasn't it, by the sculptor Ron Robertson Swan. Now describe it for me and tell me about the story.
Okay, so it's a modernist sculpture. It's yellow, bright yellow, hence the name. And when City Square was being redeveloped in central Melbourne, DCM architects proposed that an important sculpture would be placed in the square as a way of educating the public about contemporary art. And they then placed the vault there without any community engagement. And there was immediate and very significant outcry about the work. People didn't connect to it. They didn't like it. And from that, local governments learned a lot of really important lessons about ways in which to commission public arts. And they created kind of best practices where we now, generally speaking, although there are definitely exceptions to the rule, create panels that include community members, artists, gallery owners, so that artists present proposals, and it's usually competitive, either open call or a selection of artists, and then that panel work together to choose the best for that site. And that's even the case with temporary works.
If they're controversial, though, Claire, they often don't last, do they? Because, the vault, the Ron Robertson Swan sculpture, the Yellow Peril, as it was known in Melbourne popularly, was moved, wasn't it, in the end?
Moved multiple times. But if you look around the architecture of Melbourne, you'll see that very same yellow appearing everywhere. So through becoming infamous, through being initially hated, it then became completely embraced by the city, and it has found a permanent home beside ACCA, the Australian Centre of Contemporary Art. But yes, a lot of different architects, including DCM, reference it continuously. If you think about that yellow cheese stick, the huge yellow pylon, as you come into Melbourne from the airport.
Oh, yeah.
That is a reference to the vault.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that right? That yellow stick is that there to remind us that Ron Robertson Swan's vault is there somewhere in Melbourne? Go find it.
In a way, is essentially branded Melbourne. There was a period in time where tram stops were the same yellow. You have a work on EastLink that features that yellow. There's even a section of architecture at the back of RMIT, which we call the vault, which is that yellow.
Okay. Now, Troy in North Fitzroy has texted me saying, "Evening, Phil, how are you going? I go past the Yellow Peril vault every couple of months with work. It brings back memories of the city. Does anyone remember the graffiti wall that was at the city square? I'm not trying to split hairs, but its name is Vault, not the Vault. Thanks. Have a great night." Okay. All right. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Soph text saying, "Phil, hi. I expected to loathe the gigantic yellow celluloid duck in Darling Harbour in Sydney some years back. When I walked down to it, though, the sheer whimsy made my heart lift. The fact the installation was ephemeral and soon gone only added to its charm." Yeah, no, fair enough too. Fair enough too. What about in Sydney there, well, let's go through a few of them. In Sydney there was the Stones Against the Sky, the Poo on Sticks. This was Ken Unsworth's sculpture. What happened to that, Claire?
I'm actually not entirely sure of that history, but I do remember the controversy when it came out.
Yeah, exactly.
Again, I think we had an execution kind of question being asked about that work, which was slightly different to the controversy that happened around Vault.
Yes, Brisbane had its City Council outdoor gallery with light boxes and banners and vitrines and evening projections as well. Not everyone liked it. And then there's the City of Hobart's statue, of course, between late 2020 and the start of 2022. Four temporary public artworks were commissioned and installed beside the statue of William Crowther in Franklin Square. Now, they were selected to present a lot of diverse perspectives about this historical piece of art as well. This is a whole issue in itself, isn't it, about pieces of history and whether or not they should stay?
Yes, a significant question.
Yeah. What do you think about it?
Well, as a practicing artist that produces work in public space, I have a couple of permanent works, but I've actually stopped making them. And I do hold reservations about the ability to make something that's permanent,
right?
That can shift with a dynamic city like the one I live in that's growing very rapidly and changing. Having said that, a contract for a permanent public artwork, generally speaking, is about 20 to 25 years. About 15 to 20 years ago, it would have been a 50-year contract.
Mm.
It's the stuff that was commissioned earlier that doesn't have those kind of contractual barriers within it that is more difficult to remove because it doesn't have a boundary on the year on the years. So, yeah, permanent work in public space currently by most local governments actually doesn't really mean permanent in terms of forever. It does actually have a lifespan.
Hmm. Nancy, can we bring you in here? You're particularly interested in public art that makes a political statement about the culture of the day, which is often the case, I guess, with statues and monuments. Were you surprised to see the events in Hobart City Council this week? Or does it set a precedent, do you think? I mean, is this a new way of thinking about these things?
Yeah, I was really, really intrigued by that outcome in Hobart because in talking about this and thinking about this, a lot of people seem to think that statues are being pulled down all over the place. And as far as I know, that's the first time that it's actually happened in Australia through what, from what I can tell, was a really wonderful, considered, balanced sort of process. And you talked about those four artworks that were commissioned where they called for, particularly for people of Aboriginal descent to be individuals or on teams to produce those works. And one by Alan Mansell was called Truth Telling. And so because this William Crowther had stolen the skull of the man considered to be the last Tasmanian Aboriginal man back in 1869, he put red paint on his hands. He put an Aboriginal flag at his back. He put a knife in his hand in this artwork. But the terms of the commission were that anything they did had to be reversible and it couldn't be denigrating, I guess, to the statue.
Hmm.
So I thought it was a really excellent way to make what was essentially a pretty invisible statue in the Hobart landscape visible again, to draw attention to it, to make people look twice and say, what's going on there? What's the bigger story? To find out more about it. And then that has sort of gradually led to this process where they called for submissions and ultimately it came to the vote in the council this week.
Hmm. Philip is texting saying, I heard that not that long ago it would be better to leave the controversial statues in position and have a QR code that people can use their phones with, and that would tell the story of why they're not a popular person anymore or what they did wrong or why they're controversial. It's still history. It happened. You can't take that away. Remove the statue doesn't alter the fact that these people did what they did and you actually have an informed discussion about it or inform people of what really happened. Do we sometimes assume, Nancy, that because there are statues in place that these people are being celebrated? I suppose we always assume that, do we?
I think we do. And I really hear what the caller is saying. And that's what's sometimes called dialogic memorialization. So that you start with the existing statue or sculpture or memorial. You don't do anything to it, but you add to it in a way. So through a QR code is an interesting way to do it. Through an additional plaque is another way to tell a different story. So you're opening up a dialogue. You might even place another statue in close proximity to it so that they're sort of having a conversation. and you bring out those other points of view. But I guess what I worry about is that the big statue is still there, as it always has been. The second plaque down at the bottom is not necessarily going to draw the same sort of attention. It's not going to have the same presence as the statue does, still telling the original story that it told from the time that it was erected.
Mm. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about numbers of Captain Cook statues and Governor Arthur Phillips statues. In New South Wales alone, there are 28 statues of Captain Cook and 19 of Governor Arthur Phillip. Well, many people might think, well, there should be 28 statues of Captain Cook because he was an extremely significant figure. Others just tend to see it in terms of the politics of it all. What do you think we should see it as?
Well, I think that people see statues in different ways, and what we have to remember is that they can be very hurtful to people who see Captain Cook as symbolising everything about the invasion of this continent, of the everything that's happened to Indigenous people since 1770. And so I think that in terms of, as you mentioned at the beginning about truth-telling and reconciliation, that we need to think not only from our own position, but more broadly about what these statues mean. And I really loved what Claire was just saying about permanent, in quotation marks, art now having a sort of a 25-year lease. And I don't think that things necessarily have to go after whatever period of time you might say, but it's time to have another look at it and just say, is this something that we want to be occupying part of our public space? And I've been sort of thinking about all the things that you can do with a statue as you revisit it. And I think there's, you know, there's about a dozen different ways to go, from leaving it as it is, saying, great, we still love this, we want to keep it, to various ways of even enhancing it, reinterpreting, and so on and so forth, right down to removing and potentially recycling the statue.
Yeah, indeed. Claire, from an artist's point of view, I mean, do artists really want their work to be sitting there forever anyway? It doesn't sit there forever, even if it's hung in galleries, isn't it? I mean, things get moved around all of the time.
It can be really problematic, actually, particularly if local governments who are caring for them don't have the budgets to protect them properly and look after them. Yeah, absolutely. It can do it can do damage to your reputation if it is damaged and not improved. So, yeah, I mean, when artists are being commissioned, they really want to know that their work there is going to be a caretaker that is going to look after and is going to do the maintenance.
Mm. Let's take a caller to Steve. Hello. G'day, Steve.
Hey, how you going?
Not bad.
You hear me okay?
Yeah, got you.
I just want to say I was at the Q&A at Penrith tonight. It was well worth watching, if you can watch it on iView later on.
All right, yes, good.
Very interesting. Dan Grant did a good job, per usual.
What do you think about this issue?
This issue. Now, what's interesting, if you look into some of the debate around Oscar Wilde's statues in Ireland. Some of the Irish people believe his statues should be torn down because he had relationships with boys. That nowadays would be considered, I guess they would be considered pedophiles for relationships, underage boys. So anyway, and the Irish, best of my knowledge, haven't ripped down any statues. One, because his literature stands out so much. Another, because he's such a famous Irish poet and writer. And also because it's good for tourism to have those. So the guy in Tasmania, I don't even know anything about him, but is it going to be bad for tourism for Hobart that they've ripped down the statue? I don't think so.
I wouldn't imagine so, because I don't imagine anyone goes to Hobart to see a statue of William Crowther, or would even know who William Crowther was for that matter.
They might now, but you know, they'll look up his history and go, oh, that's where his statue used to be, and move on to the next part of their holiday.
Yes, fair enough. All right, Steve, thank you. Lee in Albany. G'day, Lee.
G'day, mate. How are you going?
Pretty good. What do you think?
Mate, I would say Ripping it down is probably the worst thing. I reckon putting another one up to celebrate the person who had the injustice done to them so you can compare it.
Mm.
Otherwise, you'll just forget why the new statue's been put up. You know what I mean? So you're going to go, well, what's this statue about? I don't know what's happened to us. Where if they had the statue of the gentleman there and then you had the new statue up, you can get it, or you can make your own decision of what happens. That's how I see it. I mean, I'm in Albany. I've got a statue down here of Arakat, the Turkish president during the First World War.
Ataturk, yeah.
Yeah, you could take offence to that, or someone probably has.
Mm.
But, you know, I don't. I'd sort of like go with it and see how it is. But, yeah, you can read it either way. I don't think there's going to be a right or a wrong way to it.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Lee. Claire McCracken's a practicing artist and theorist with us, and so is Nancy Cushing, who's a professor in history at the University of Newcastle. Claire,
could I just mention something about Ireland?
Yes, go on.
Thanks. So, yeah, just talking about what they're doing in Ireland, just as one example, they are not that enamoured of the British royal family. And so they had some spare statues of Queen Victoria. There was one that was erected in 1908 and was considered repugnant to the Irish nation. And so it was removed in 1948 and sort of ended up outside a boys' reformatory gathering moss. But then when they needed or wanted a statue for the QBB in Sydney in the 1980s, it was negotiated that would be gifted to Australia. And so she sits outside the QBB with some shamrocks in her decoration. So that's another thing that you can do. You can find a new home. You can find someone who might love the statue more than you do in its original place.
Mm. Claire, from an artist's point of view again here, is there a distinction between memorialising statues and public sculpture, for example? And from an artistic point of view, how do you distinguish between the two?
Now, there's plenty of examples of contemporary memorials, and people do audits of their memorials. Mm. And in doing that, cities have discovered that there's a lack of representation. So they may have discovered that there was a lack of memorials covering women's history or Australians of colour or First Nations Australians.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll remedy that by creating contemporary memorials. And I mean, there's examples of right around Australia, but the ones I'm most familiar with are the ones I walk past daily, which is the Women's Suffrage Monument that was installed about 15 years ago in Melbourne, which was installed because of the lack of monuments in the city to women.
Mm. Yeah, indeed. 1-300-800-222. What did we learn from overseas? Because the Romans, for example, regularly changed their statues out, didn't they? Particularly when there was a new emperor come along.
That's right, and sometimes didn't replace the whole statue, but just the head.
Knocked the head off and made a new.
Put the new emperor's head on. So they recycled. I think that's another thing that we could do with some of our statues. Sometimes they melted down the bronze ones to make new statues or other things. Some of the marble ones were pulverized for mortar.
Mm.
So they didn't necessarily have this sort of sense that statues should never change, that they were there in perpetuity. And most of the Roman statues that we now see in museums and so on just fell into complete disregard. They ended up buried and they weren't known at all through the Middle Ages, and it wasn't until the Renaissance that they were being excavated. And then suddenly there was this renewed interest in statues very much on those Roman and classical lines being made new in the Europe of the Renaissance and onward.
Mm. Is there enough space in Australia, do you think, Claire, for because a lot of art is commissioned, isn't it, by wealthy art lovers who have got the means to commission artists to make these works. Is there enough opportunity, do you think, in public spaces for that kind of commissioning to take place, or is it too much of an official bureaucratic commission?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think increasingly there is. So the sector became very aware that the same types of artists were getting commissions.
Yeah.
because, of course, it's really hard to build something that's engineered to be resilient enough to go in public space. And we are using fabricators, but to speak the language of fabricators is also a complex technical skill. So there's lots of really innovative models. The Brisbane work that we talked about before that uses light boxes and banners, they're really simple ways of providing sites in public space for emerging artists that may not have the confidence to negotiate those systems. Mm-hmm. There's other ways that we can really foster new talent and diverse voices by running workshops and having really lengthy engagements with sites with emerging artists, often from the local community, so that you build their talent and confidence up. And then you help them work with the fabricator to develop the work safely for public space. And there's examples of that right across Australia happening in many different local governments.
Mm. You mentioned before silo art, Claire. This has become a thing in regional Australia, hasn't it? Particularly in grain and wheat towns, where the railway siding, of course, it was often dominated by massive grain silos, which a lot of regional towns have commissioned artwork on them. And there's a dam in Western Australia which has had a similar mural artwork representing the local history of the population. Is this a way too for artists to find a not just a voice, but to find a means of expression?
Yeah, and there's different commissioning processes going on there, but I think the best ones are the ones where they upskill local artists from that community to produce the work.
Mm-hmm.
And there are examples of that, but often you are seeing urban artists being pulled to those regional communities. But I think the healthiest commissioning processes are ones where you work with your local talent, because there's artists distributed right across Australia.
Yeah, there are. Graham in the Central West. Hello, Graham.
G'day, how are you?
Not bad.
I just want to say, with people wanting to bewildle James Cook and Arthur Phillip and not have statues to them, I think their achievements have been far overshadowed by the Indigenous issues. I mean, there was a great man, and what they achieved was really monumental, you know, compared to things that happen in any other country, you know. James Cook didn't turn up here and start shooting Aboriginals. He discovered Australia and New Zealand and had to be up in Tahiti to time to measure the transit of Venus so we knew how the distance from the sun, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
No, you know what I mean, there was a lot more to the voyage of discovery.
Of course there was. No, I mean, that's... Nancy, back to you on this historical thing. That, I mean, to some extent that's true, and it's just a matter of correction, by the way. Cook did actually have a shot at the Aboriginal population.
He did.
When he was here, both at the first sighting of the Aboriginal people and also subsequently up on the Great Barrier Reef, he certainly shot at them. So it's not true that he didn't. But, I mean, historians are forever, and this is a proper work of historians, isn't it? To rewrite, to look, to sift again, to take interpretations, to fashion interpretations of history that makes sense of it to people of their generation. This is what historians have always done. I mean, is pulling down statues and destroying these things, is it almost equivalent to book burning? In the sense that if we don't like it, we destroy it?
Yes, I think that you raise a good point. I wouldn't equate it to book burning, but also, as I was saying before, I think there's lots of different things that can happen to statues, and it's really on the real extremity that you tear down and destroy, like burning a book. And so what they're proposing to do in Hobart, for example, is to move the statue 1.5 blocks to the Art Gallery and Museum, where they can protect it, conserve it, but they can interpret it sort of in the round from a number of different perspectives and give it that attention that no doubt it deserves, because there is a really important story to be told around that figure.
And that's the important thing, isn't it? It's telling the story, isn't it, rather than memorialising the figure.
Yes, exactly. And there are so many people involved in that story and so many nuances and so on. But when it's just standing there as a kind of a mute memorial, those stories aren't being told in the same way. So I absolutely agree with you that history is always being rewritten, and that is something that people say, oh, we can't tear down a statue because that's rewriting history. But that is exactly what historians do.
They do all the time. And no one suggests that so-and-so's, you know, historian's work should be taken out of libraries and burnt or removed from libraries, do they? No one says this.
They don't.
So why should public memorialisations be any different?
Well, it goes to the stack. So if you go to your state library in your state and have a look at the history books, they'll be reasonably recent history books. They'll be from the last 20 years. But you can also fill in a request slip and you can get one that was printed in 1881. And it'll tell a very different story about whatever sort of history you want to find out about. But, you know, they both still have merit. For historians, they go from being secondary sources to being primary sources, so sources that we would use to find out about that time when it was written. And that's what statues are good for too, helping us to understand the period in which they were created. Mm. But that doesn't mean that history still has a currency in today's world.
No, because you might argue that the story of Captain Cook, or Lieutenant Cook as he was when he was here, the story of Cook is an important one in the history of Australia. It's obviously important in the history of Australia, and an important story in its own right. So therefore, that's the story that ought to be told. Of course, it has other contexts. But Cook wasn't just a coloniser. He was all sorts of things. And in the story of Australia, there are threads of his story that make up the fabric of Australia, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. And his voyage was so important to the subsequent history of Australia for everyone that's lived on this continent. So he's not someone who should be erased from history by any means, but removing a statue or moving a statue to a museum or moving it to a quieter location doesn't change the past. It just changes that statue. You know, I think it's the, you know, there's the past and there's history and there's historical evidence. And I think we get kind of muddied about what statues really are.
Yeah. 1-300-800-222 is the number. We're talking about statues and public art, and sparked in part by the decision of the Hobart City Council this last couple of weeks to decide to remove a statue of the Premier, or former Premier from the 19th century, William Crowther, and having moved somewhere elsewhere because of actions he took in relation to the desecration of an Aboriginal man, William Lanny, and his body, which lay in the morgue, and he removed the head of William Lanny in what today would be regarded as most appalling behaviour, of course. 1-300-800-222, text 0467-922-702. Barbara from Taree. Hello, Barbara.
Oh hello. I'm very worried about what's going to happen to our beautiful Italian heritage.
Mm-hmm.
We had wonderful sculptors like Simonetti and Tommaso Sarni. And Simonetti's statues are in the New South Wales Parliament.
Mm, and what? And, go on.
And they show what the people look like. That they help to make history come to life, I think.
Mm.
And Tommaso Sarni did a lot of sculpture of ordinary people, not just, you know, the superstars of history.
Mm-hmm.
And on the north spandrels of the GPO, he shows scenes from everyday life in the 19th century. It just shows a lady going into a bank.
Mm.
And there's people just... And a lot of these statues were paid for by public subscription.
That's true.
Like the... Yes. And the Yorkshire Society raised a lot of money to create the statue of Captain Cook in the Botanical Gardens.
Mm. Okay. Yep. No, good point. Thank you, Barbara. Mike on the line from Austinville. Yep. G'day, Mike.
Yep. Hi there. I just want to reiterate the silo trail.
Yeah.
That's a great program which encourages people to travel around and observe that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'll start with a serious note, which was the statues of figures who were associated with black slavery from the UK and the US, and they've been replaced and torn down and
mm-hmm.
Very controversial. But on a lighthearted note, one up in Byron Bay, which was erected on a roundabout made of metallic seagulls in the shape of the lighthouse there at Cape Byron,
mm-hmm.
but it blocked the vision of motorists as they, you know, navigated the roundabout, and it was colloquially called the big D.
Mm-hmm.
And another one at the entrance to Rockhampton, which was a large bull, and apparently people often disconnect its manhood, and there's someone permanently assigned to
reattach it.
Reattach them out of brass. And
all right. Well, a desecration's always a thing, I guess, too. Thank you. 1-300-800-222. Tony from Borkham Hills. G'day, Tony.
Hi, Philip. How are you?
Not bad. What do you reckon?
I reckon that the statues are part of our history, and they're a snapshot in time. It's captured and put in place, and it helps tell us the historical story.
Mm.
Some people take offence to them from time to time, but I've got to say, if you have a look at the Anzac Bridge, the sentinels, the members that are standing there as soldiers, nobody's taken offence to that. The Sir James Martin as a youth statue in Parramatta,
mm-hmm.
which talks about his history before he became as a youth. Nobody's taken offence to that. I think you look at Trim the Cat at the State Library.
Mm-hmm.
That's unoffensive. And it's all in the eyes of the person that's perceiving it. And I think if there's... We've got a problem in depicting early Aboriginal history as against colonial history. Australia is a country that's very, very young.
Yes,
but the need to be able to also designate and be able to define Australian Aboriginal heritage is limited because of the restrictions on being able to get a family to allow the depiction of a person of Aboriginal heritage, and I think that needs to be looked at and further developed, and it's our history. We're part of that, and I think. With any artist that contributes to it, I think they've got an expectation for that statue to be in place for 25 years and then have somebody review it. And if it hasn't offended anybody or there's a balance that can be had, it's all about balance, but reflecting history. Don't try and change history. Recognise it and understand it. And if you need to further define it with a balance point, then do so.
Okay. All right. Nancy, you'd probably say hear, hear to that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I don't think we need to go looking for problems. I agree. Trim the Cat is a really nice addition to the windowsill at the State Library in Sydney. But I'm also thinking about how Indigenous Australians are now erecting their own statues.
Yeah.
And so recently there's been some attention to one in Gundagai of two Wiradjuri men who saved the town from a flood back in the mid-19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And there was recently a sort of celebration around that. And there were a number of Wiradjuri people who were being quoted of saying, you know, how proud they were, how great it made them feel to see their ancestors being recognized in this way. So yes, I think adding to the store of statues is one way to help to alleviate some of the concern around them. I don't think it's a total solution, but yeah, so that's one direction that.
Yes, and you might argue that Tasmanians could erect a, you know, a statue to Tongalongata or one, you know, or one of the other early Aboriginal leaders who led the resistance, and that might be a better way too, or a good way of telling the story. Claire, can we just move back to you too on this issue of public art generally? A number of people have said how much they felt their spirits were uplifted by it. And to some degree, you know, when we began this conversation, we talked about the big banana and the big trout, for example. Is there not enough fun in public spaces, do you think, with public artwork? I'm thinking in a big way of the Christo wrappings, for example, which are awesome and fun and pure, and also of their nature purely temporary. Is there not enough fun being had, do you think?
I think there's a lot of fun works. I think that there's political works and there's also interactive and fun works. I mean, anybody who walked around Sydney during Vivid will have seen a whole lot of fun and interactive work. But we have to acknowledge that public space is very precious and it's something for everybody. And we all must feel comfortable moving through it. And so that means that questioning public art and what we're commissioning is really important, both looking at existing works, but also what's on the horizon.
So in other words, plonking a big statue in the middle of a public space and saying, well, that's it, that's what's going to be there for the next 50 years or more, is not a way to go. Is that what you're saying?
It can be. I mean, there are great examples of grand legacy works that really make a city a city, but there's also notorious examples. In the US, there's a very famous Richard Sierra sculpture that was a huge, massive sheet of steel, much taller than a human and about 20 metres long, which blocked people's egress across a square. So, you know, eventually it's removed because people actually can't use that public space as they needed to. So, I mean, I think that when it comes to monuments, my question, and any public art, my question is, does the community as a whole feel comfortable walking through this space? And if they don't, well, then we need to ask questions and we need to listen to those people that don't feel safe in that space and see if we can rectify that.
1-300-800-222. Latif in Brunswick. G'day, Latif.
Good day, good evening. Two points briefly. One is that where do they go? What do we do with them? All these artworks taken away, what happens to them? And secondly, that even there is also public art, lesser scale, smaller, in like local council, state government buildings, and federal buildings, ministries, in the foyers, like Parliament House in Canberra. Lots of artworks there, mainly modern and contemporary. That's still public places, you know, like community public places. Yeah, that's all I can say.
Yeah, okay. I mean, Nancy, I think the point you were making is that you don't necessarily destroy these things. You take them somewhere and tell their story somewhere else rather than
and you know, on the playful scale too, that has been happening in some other places, and I guess the best example is in Tallinn in Estonia, where there is a park filled with statues of Lenin and Stalin and Engels and Marx and all the sort of Soviet heroes who are surplus to requirements now in Estonia.
And so it's a kind of boneyard for former Soviet heroes, isn't
exactly.
it?
So putting them all together makes them all, you know, it's sort of, it takes away the dignity that those statues initially had and you know, en masse. So people crawl all over them and they take selfies with them and they're not on the plinth anymore. They're down on ground level. They're more on a human scale. scale. And so that's one thing that has been done. There's a section of Gorky Park in Moscow, which is the Fallen Monument Park, and Coronation Park in New Delhi that has a whole lot of old British statues in it. So that's one way that countries are dealing with this surplus of statues.
Mm. And I guess approval is another thing, isn't it, Claire? I mean, I saw when I was in the UK recently that statue commemorating the life and work of Mary Wollstonecraft, one of the great sort of feminist pioneers, which is in a public park in, I think, Stoke Newington or near there in London. But, of course, highly controversial because the artist has portrayed her completely in the nude, which there's nothing wrong with, you know, that depiction of itself, but many would think, well, this is inappropriate, and there's almost a public vote to remove it. How much is public approval important here?
Well, in the history of public art, it's been very important, and things are quite regularly removed. And the best we can do is those kind of best practice commissioning processes where we have panels that have community members on them, historians and specialists in the field, to make sure that we avoid some of those things. But of course, we don't always get it right. Having said that, sometimes controversy isn't a bad thing. It can generate a really interesting discussion. And I think particularly in temporary public artworks that could be up for 5 minutes or a year or, you know, a month, having something that creates a really interesting community discourse can activate your community in ways that many other things can't, because it's there in public space and people can stand and look and engage and have a conversation between each other. And, you know, when you were talking about the Karratha monument and those temporary installations, that's a prime example of that, where people are interacting with that monument in order to get a really rich dialogue happening in public space, which then concludes in a decision to remove that monument.
Hmm. Christine, hello.
Oh, hello. I just think, just to reiterate, that the balance is really important. It doesn't always have to be statues like that lovely new women's fish hook that's now in the Botanical Gardens. At least that's one of the first things that, you know, to recognise our First Nations people. You know, it doesn't have to be humans or, you know, a Barangaroo sort of person like we might, you know, like you're talking about with statues, but it is a matter of balance. Like on the Central Coast at Nora Head, there's all this memorial to, you know, shipwrecks and things like that. But there's a tiny little thing saying that, you know, Barangaroo was also here and, you know, and Bennelong was here. So it's, and the access to get to through local councils for public art is really quite difficult. And there was some really great public art by community artist Peter Day, who had was on the bottom of the Harbour Bridge and in Surrey Hills and things. But they were murals and they come and go. But it is a matter of finding, you know, other ways, just not, you know, human representations.
Yep, no, fair enough, and fair enough point too. We'll have to leave it, Christine, because we are up against a time limit. Telling stories, and the more we can tell stories and the more stories we can tell, I guess, Nancy, the more and richer our life will be. Thanks to both of you. Nancy Cushing is a professor in history at the University of Newcastle. Claire McCracken's an artist and theorist at RMIT. We've been discussing public art as well as public statues. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Claire McCracken and Nancy Cushing.